very different kind of style of meeting Kadula for worship. Last weekend I was at my mum and dad's church and had the opportunity to play drums because their drummer didn't turn up on time. So I got to play drums, which I haven't done in ages and ages. So that was pretty good. Anyway. Really nice to see you. See if you're not regularly with us, just to say it's great, especially to have you with us this morning. Please stay for a cuppa afterwards. We'd love to just have a chat and get to know you better. That would be great. Well, today I'm starting a new series. I'm sorry the projector's playing up. It wasn't at the start of the service, so I don't know what's going on now. But you know, there we go. But starting a new series, which I'm calling Wonder Women. Looking at some of the great women of the Old Testament, actually, and seeing what we can learn through them. Because so many of the characters that we engage with, that we find doing things for God in the Old Testament, are men, but they're not exclusively men. So we need to draw upon that, and we need to see what the Lord can teach us through that. Why do I call it Wonder Women? Well, I named it after the... after these two, bit of a shock, I know, on a Sunday morning, but you know instantly who they are. The one on the left, that's the new film that came out last year, slightly different mode of dress, but nonetheless, still Wonder Woman there. And Wonder Woman was in the news in the end of, before that actually, in the end of 2016. This headline, UN drops Wonder Woman as honorary ambassador. Wonder Woman has been stripped of her role, this came from CNN, as a United Nations honorary ambassador for the empowerment of women and girls, less than 2 months after the controversial appointment was made. When it was announced on October the 21st, so it was a 2-month appointment it seems, that the scantily clad comic book character had been chosen as a figurehead for the feminist campaign, many UN workers protested. A UN spokesman said the decision was made to end this ambassadorship soon after the launch to end it on that date, and it wasn't being brought forward due to the protest. But there had been a petition from United Nations members of staff. They said the comic book character is not culturally encompassing or sensitive and was an inappropriate choice at a time when the headline news in the United States and the world is the objectification of women and girls. And they actually protested during the ceremony appointing Wonder Woman as ambassador. On their petition website they wrote, although the original creators may have intended Wonder Woman to represent a strong and independent warrior woman with a feminist message, the reality is that the character's current iteration is that of a large-breasted, white woman of impossible proportions, scantily clad in a shimmering thigh-bearing bodysuit with an American flag motif and knee-high boots, the epitome of a pin-up girl. The petition has attracted more than 44,000 supporters by the time the announcement was made that Wonder Woman's role would end. So we are very much in the real world with this series. Today we're looking at a person. I've tried to think up a superhero type name, so I've come up with Dazzling Deborah. It's not really very good, but it's the best I can do. Dazzling Deborah. Marvelous Maeve, you see, because Marvelous Maeve's middle name was Deborah. So actually it's quite appropriate that we're looking at Deborah today, because Marvelous Maeve was a bit of a Wonder Woman, really, wasn't she? We all loved her. She was great. So we'll look at Judges chapter 4. Should we read that now? Yeah, let's do that now. So if you want to follow that, you can do it in the lo-fi paper Bible like mine. You could do it in a high-tech version by turning on your phone or your tablet, whatever it is. Or you can, of course, as well, find it inside the welcome sheets that you received when you came in. Here's Judges chapter 4. It's not a long, short story, but it is a good one. So here we go. After Ehud's death, the Israelites again did evil in the Lord's sight, so the Lord turned them over to King Jabin of Hazor, a Canaanite king. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in this place beginning with H. Sisera who had 900 iron chariots ruthlessly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help. Deborah, the wife of Lapidoth, was a prophet who was judging Israel at that time. She would sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites would go to her for judgment. One day she sent for Barak, who lived in Kedesh in the land of Naphtali. She said to him, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you. Call out 10,000 warriors from the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun at Mount Tabor, and I'll call out Sisera, commander of Jabin's army, along with his chariots and warriors, to the Kishon River. There I will give you victory over him." Barak told her, "I will go, but only if you go with me." "Very well," she replied, "I will go with you, but you will receive no honor in this venture, for the Lord's victory over Sisera will be at the hands of a woman." So Deborah went with Barak to Kedesh. At Kedesh, Barak called together the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali, and 10,000 warriors went up with him. Deborah also went with him. Now Heber, the Kenite, a descendant of Moses' brother-in-law, Hobab, had moved away from the other members of his tribe and pitched his tent by the oak of Zenaim, near Kedesh. When Sisera was told that Barak, son of this guy, had gone up to Mount Tabor, he called for all of his 900 iron chariots and all his warriors, and they marched from that place, beginning with H, to the Kishon River. Then Deborah said to Barak, "Get ready. This is the day the Lord will give you victory over Sisera, for the Lord is marching out ahead of you." So Barak led his 10,000 warriors down the slopes of Mount Tabor into battle. When Barak attacked, the Lord threw Sisera and all his chariots and warriors into a panic. Sisera leapt down from his chariot and escaped on foot. Then Barak chased the chariots and the enemy army all the way to this place beginning with H, killing all of Sisera's warriors. Not a single one was left. Meanwhile, Sisera ran to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, because Heber's family was on friendly terms with King Jabin of Hazor. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Come into my tent, sir. Come in, don't be afraid." So he went into her tent, and she covered him with a blanket. "Please give me some water," he said. "I'm thirsty." So she gave him some milk from a leather bag and covered him again. "Stand at the door of the tent," he told her. "If anyone comes and asks you if there's anyone here, say no." But when Sisera fell asleep from exhaustion, Jael quietly crept up to him with a hammer and tent peg in her hand. Then she drove the tent peg through his temple and into the ground. So he died. When Barak came looking for Sisera, Jael went out to meet him. She said, "Come, I'll show you the man you're looking for." So he followed her into the tent and found Sisera lying there dead, with a tent peg through his temple. So on that day, Israel saw God defeat Jabin, the Canaanite king. And from that day on, Israel became stronger and stronger against King Jabin until they finally destroyed him. And it tells us at the end of the following chapter that there was then peace in the land for 40 years. This business of women's rights is very much in the news at the moment. It's the centenary of British suffrage, when women were first campaigning for and granted the vote after the end of the First World War. But even now, there are still issues, ongoing issues with sexual equality in all kinds of places. So again, this news story from this week, you may have seen this. Qatar Airways boss says sorry for joke that a woman could not do his job. This is from Sky. The chief executive of Qatar Airways has apologised for saying a woman couldn't do his job, saying it was just a joke. Akbar Al-Bakir tried to calm the controversy over his remarks, saying the press blew it out of proportion. He made his remark in Sydney on Tuesday, shortly after he was appointed chairman of the International Air Transport Association at its annual meeting. Responding to a question on whether women could do his job, Mr. Al-Bakir told reporters, "Of course it has to be led by a man because it's a very challenging position." The conference included a focus on gender diversity, as only 6 of its 280 member airlines have female chief executives. So this seems like a good reason to be looking at this kind of stuff at the moment. That this is in the news, this is fresh, this is current. And we've come here and we've found Deborah leading the people of Israel. We'll come back to her in just a moment. But I thought it might help you just to know what's going on in Judges. So what I've done is I've just summarised some of chapter 2 of Judges, which helps us get the scene of what's going on. So the Israelites served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and the leaders who outlived him, those who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. So the people have come out of slavery in Egypt under Moses. Then they've entered the promised land with Joshua heading them up, leading them. And now all those folk have died. After that generation died, another generation grew up who did not acknowledge the Lord. Come on. Who did not acknowledge the Lord or remember the mighty things he'd done for Israel. They abandoned the Lord, the God of their ancestors who'd brought them out of Egypt. They went after other gods, worshipping the gods of the people around them. This made the Lord burn with anger against Israel, so he handed them over to raiders who stole their possessions. He turned them over to their enemies all around, and they were no longer able to resist them. Every time Israel went out to battle, the Lord fought against them, causing them to be defeated just as he'd warned, and the people were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges to rescue the Israelites from their attackers. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge over Israel, he was with that judge and rescued the people from their enemies throughout the judge's lifetime. For the Lord took pity on his people who were burdened by oppression and suffering. But when the judge died, the people returned to their corrupt ways, behaving worse than those who had lived before them. So we have this pattern of a series of judges, people who God chooses in order to lead his people and to restore peace and to restore order to the nation. Because the people keep turning away from God. They keep going after other gods, the gods of the nations around them. And God wants their worship. They've made a covenant. They've made a promise to him, and he's made a promise to them. And they're not fulfilling their end of the bargain. So we come to this story today, the story of Deborah. And there's 4 key players in this story. There is Deborah herself. She's the judge, the leader of Israel. Then there is Barak. He is going to be the leader of the king's army. Then there's Sisera. He's the baddie. He is the commander of the enemy army. And lastly, there's Jael. And I didn't know a Jael, so I've got J-Lo instead. I hope that's okay. So there's 4 main characters. Let's start with Deborah. Deborah, as the leader of God's people here, she's very much following in Moses' footsteps. If you have a look at verse 4, this is our key verse really for Deborah. It says, she's the wife of Lapidoth, whoever that is. She was a prophet who was judging Israel at that time. In other words, there's 2 things about Deborah. Firstly, that she is a judge. We're told that the Israelites would go to her for judgment. She knew God's law, she was wise, and people came to ask for her assistance in sorting out these matters. She's a wise woman, if you like. But she also has authority. She's a judge. And we see Moses doing exactly that. You might remember the story with Moses about all the people coming to him to sort out their issues and the judgments. And Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, says, wait, Moses, this is too much for you. Why don't you appoint some other people to share this load with you? So he does. No idea if that was continuing. But nonetheless, here is Deborah, and she is a judge. She's following in Moses' footsteps. And secondly, she's a prophet. Moses is described as a prophet in Deuteronomy 34. In fact, one of the great things that Moses says in Deuteronomy 18 is, hey, look, wait, because the Lord is going to raise up for you from amongst you another prophet like me. Look out for him. Look out for when he comes. Deborah is not that person, but neither is Ehud, who comes before her, or Othniel, that comes before him, or Samson, or Gideon. None of them turn out to be that person. But nonetheless, Deborah is a prophet. That means that she speaks words from God. She hears God's voice, and she speaks. And she does that exactly that, doesn't she? She does that too when she calls for Barak. She says, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you. There's much that we don't know about her. We don't know about her family. We only know she's married to this guy called Lapidoth. We don't know her age. We don't know where she's from. She sits under this palm called the Palm of Deborah. It says between Ramah and Bethel. Well, there's about 20 miles between Ramah and Bethel. You know, in fact, there's a place right in the middle called Mizpah. Was it there? I don't know. Did she live there? Did she come from another part of the country and she made that her home because it was central? I don't know. What about her backgrounds? You know, quite often we get these lists of you know, so-and-so, the father of so-and-so, or the son of that person, or who, again, we don't know. What was her lineage? We don't know. And how on earth did she come to be a prophet? How did she come to be the judge of Israel? No idea. So there's much we don't know about Deborah. But there is a lot that we can tell about her. You might call her the woman of steel, or maybe the Iron Lady of her day. I don't mean to be funny about that. I mean, yeah, the first one's based on Superman. But the second one, Iron Lady, you know? Whatever you think of Margaret Thatcher, is it a good description of her? Yes, it is. And I can kind of see that in Deborah, that she's a really strong figure. She's commanding, isn't she? She says, hey, Barak, you come. Come to see me here because I've got an instruction for you. And so she sends for him. And he travels 80 miles from Kadesh, where he's living, to Deborah's palm, somewhere between Ramah and Bethel. 80 miles he came to see her when she said, come. That's quite a lot of authority, isn't it? She's also fearless. She has no trouble at all in saying, very well, I'll go with you, but by the way, you're not going to get any glory for yourself in this. No honour for you, matey. Whew! That's quite a bold thing to say. Come on. She's also confident. What did I choose there? Verse 14. Again, she's the one who says to Barak, get ready. This is the day the Lord's going to give you victory. She's absolutely certain on it. She doesn't waver on it. She doesn't add any ifs or buts. She just says, this is the day, and you're going to be victorious. She's totally confident. And so what I see here is this interesting situation where her role is never questioned. Nobody says, excuse me, Deborah, you shouldn't be doing this. You're a woman. Nobody says that. But there is an issue. And the issue surrounds Barak. In fact, you might call it a bit of an embarrassment. You see, the problem for Barak is that he doesn't seem to have the kind of confidence that Deborah has. He says when she tells him, go and, you know, lead out the army and you're going to have victory, in verse 8 he says, I'll go, but only if you go with me. To be honest, that's a slight shortening of what he actually says. He actually says, if you go, I'll go, and if you don't go, I won't go. Which is fine in one sense. You know, it shows his confidence in Deborah. On the other hand, is he kind of treating her like a tarisman, talisman, like a good luck charm or something? You know, well, if you come too, then I'll win, but I can't do this, you know, on my own. I can't trust what you say. I can't really trust what you're saying about God. So why don't you come too? And then, you know, if I get in a bit of a pickle, maybe you can sort things out. That's a bit embarrassing. And so that is why then Deborah really adds to his embarrassment by saying, very well, I'll go with you, but you'll receive no honour, for the Lord's victory over Sisera will be at the hands of a woman. See, it is that male thing. Granted, there were odd tribes like the Amazon women, you've probably heard about, where women did fight. In fact, Celts in the UK, their women would fight. But obviously it wasn't the way in Israel. And so for a male army to be told that, hey, it's not, or a male commander to say, well, you might win the battle, but actually you're not going to get any honour in this. There's going to be a woman. And she's going to be the one through whom God gives the victory. It's quite embarrassing for him. It's embarrassing for him. But you know what? It's not embarrassing for God. God doesn't have that problem. He's quite glad to do this. He has no problem with doing this. And so as the story unfolds, we discover this other person, Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. And she's quite a woman as well. See, she's loyal, unlike her husband. That business, that weird thing that the author of Judges mentions about him moving his tent away from the other Kenites. And we're told it actually it's because he's on friendly terms with the enemy king. That's disloyalty, isn't it? It's disloyalty to his own people. It's disloyalty to God. But she's not like that. She may not be able to stop him moving their tent. But at least she's loyal. Secondly, she's clever. She must have this plan. As soon as she recognizes him, she has this plan. Come into my tent. Don't be afraid. It's a blatant lie. Come into my tent. There's nothing to worry about. We're friends, aren't we? You know, we hang out with you guys and, you know, we're on friendly terms, so that's all right. Come and hide in my tent. That would be a great place, wouldn't it? You know. Well, she's leading him up the garden path. She's very, very clever. And then you see it again, I think. He says, give me some water. And she gives him some milk. Because if you fill the stomach up more, it makes you sleepier, doesn't it? You know? Have some really nice, full fat, full cream milk. Whoa, quite fancy that after my battle. You know, oh, that would be really good. Oh, and let me just lie down under this blanket as well, you know, because I won't fall asleep then, will I? If I have a full tummy and lie down under a blanket. Well, no, that's exactly what she's planning. Silly man. And then finally, of course, she's bold. You can imagine her, maybe with her hands trembling a bit, with this mallet in this tent peg, creeping up behind him. She's got to act really swiftly. Because if he senses that she's there and he turns round, you know, if he wakes up and sees what she's about to do, she won't be able to go through with it. So she's bold and she's swift and she takes the opportunity and she does it. He staked his life on her. She staked his head to the ground. I knew you'd like that, Helen. I knew you'd like that. So this is the wonderful story. And then, you know, bringing Barak at the end. Oh, you're looking for this guy, are you? Here he is, here. You know, you lost him. You should have been running after Sisera when everyone else was fleeing that battlefield. You had 10,000 men to chase up their guys. And what did you do? Did you follow the other enemy leader? Because that's your job. No, you didn't. No, you just got caught up in it all. You didn't do your job. So she did it for him. So that's the story, isn't it? Great. Isn't it a fantastic story? I love it. Judges is one of the most comically violent books in the whole of the Old Testament. It's fantastic. But it leaves us a small problem of where on earth does the cross fit into this? This wonderful story, where does the cross fit in? Three things that I think, firstly, that we can say absolutely. Firstly, this one. That Jesus is the ultimate rescuer. These stories in Judges, God raises up a judge who rescues the people. Well, Jesus is the rescuer, isn't he? We get verses like this in the New Testament. He is the one who has rescued us from the terrors of the coming judgment. How has he done that? Through the cross. He's our rescuer. The people of Israel, with these enemies, they are under God's judgment. God delivers them from that through a rescuer. Second thing, Jesus is the ultimate prophet. Deborah was this prophet, remember? She speaks words from God. Jesus is the ultimate prophet. Not just because he speaks God's word, but because he is, in himself, God's word. That is who he is. You don't need to go to somebody to listen to God's word. When you come across Jesus, you encounter him, you encounter it personified. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word was with God in the beginning. Who is John talking about? He's talking about Jesus. And then the Word became human. We've seen his glory. John writes, we've seen this for ourselves. So Jesus is more than a prophet. He is God's very Word in the flesh. He tells us everything we need to know about God. Thirdly, we're looking at the book of Judges. Well, Jesus is the ultimate judge. Paul says to the people in Athens in Acts 17, he says that God has proven that Jesus is the ultimate judge by raising him from the dead. The resurrection is part of this. The resurrection shows us who God has chosen to be the judge of all the earth. Why? Because he's the first. He's the greatest. No one else has risen, have they? No. But God has raised him. And so he stands, like Deborah, only in a much, much greater and better way, as the judge of all the earth. Now, lots of these things, or rather these three things, we may well be able to say about many of the prophets, many of the judges in this book of the Old Testament. These things are true. Here's something, though, particular, perhaps, out of this story. And that is to speak, like we talked of embarrassment, the embarrassment of the cross. What do I mean by that? Firstly, I don't mean that I am embarrassed by the cross. It's not a problem for me. In fact, it's not a problem for any Christian. And it's certainly not embarrassing for God. But Paul writes this for us in 1 Corinthians. He says, the message of the cross is foolishness to those headed for destruction. But we who are being saved know it's the very power of God. And he goes on to talk about how the cross for Jews is a stumbling block. Here's something they just can't get over. It's frankly embarrassing, the idea that the Messiah should come and suffer and die. That's not what a Messiah does. That's embarrassing. A Messiah dying in weakness, stretched out on a Roman cross of all things, a place of cursing. The Old Testament law says cursed is anybody who dies on a tree, or is hung on a tree, I should say. And the cross came to be known as the tree because Jews understood people who were being crucified as fulfilling that. You were cursed, in their view, by God, if you died on a cross. That's embarrassing. It's embarrassing if the person who's supposed to be saving you is cursed by God. And the Greeks as well, Paul goes on, you know, they're looking for great rational arguments. They want something profoundly, you know, impressive and all this. The last thing they want is a guy from a backwater of Galilee, a Jew who's not even a Greek, who ends up dead on a cross. It's just foolishness to them. It is embarrassing. I won't believe that. So it's foolishness to those headed for destruction, but we who are saved know it's the very power of God. The cross is not embarrassing for God. Eric kindly sent me a story this week from the news. Do you remember doing that, Eric? Yeah. And I thought, I've got to get that in on Sunday. So here it goes. Okay, it comes from the BBC. Crocodile kills Ethiopian pastor during lake baptism. A crocodile has killed a Protestant pastor who was baptizing followers near a lake in southern Ethiopia. Docho Esheti was conducting the ceremony for about 80 people on Sunday morning at Lake Abaya. Residents and police told the BBC a crocodile leapt from the water during the baptism and attacked him. Pastor Docho died after being bitten on his legs, back and hands. He baptized the first person and then passed on to another one, and all of a sudden a crocodile jumped out of the lake and grabbed the pastor, local residents Katima Cairo told the BBC. Despite huge efforts, fishermen and residents couldn't save Pastor Docho. Policeman, I can't even pronounce his name, Kanko is his surname, said they used fishing nets to prevent the crocodile from taking the pastor's body into the lake. The crocodile escaped. Now that's pretty sad. In that sense, my heart goes out to these folk. I wouldn't want that to be me. But I could just imagine that when they were planning this, his wife said, do not baptize people in the lake. You will not come out alive. You know, I can imagine his wife saying that to him, telling him what a silly idea it was. They know where crocodiles are, don't they? And I can imagine, because I would do the same thing, I would say, don't worry, dear, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. Don't worry. It'll be fine. And sadly, it wasn't fine. He wanted maybe to be able to say, look, I have baptized all these people in a crocodile-infested river, and the Lord has kept these crocodiles away. Maybe he wanted to do that. Again, that's a very man thing to want to do, to prove that you're right all the time, and, you know, that kind of stuff. You're laughing, but you know it's true, don't you? Yeah? And so I think maybe when we look at this story, we need to think a little about redressing the balance. And we need to start perhaps with the idea that men have nothing to boast about. We're not better than women in the eyes of God. You know, a passage from 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that talks about the foolishness of the cross goes on to say, nobody has any reason to boast before the Lord. So if you're going to boast, boast in him. That's it. It's not like we men had an advantage before we came to faith. You know, that God was looking for slightly less from us than he was from the women because they're not quite as good as us or something. We've got nothing to boast about. And yet we carry on half the time like, you know, we know all the answers and we get it all right. I wrote down this when I was preparing, just reflecting basically on the story of Deborah and the judges, that faithlessness, brings ruin. That was what was happening to them. The people were faithless towards God, and it brought them ruin. But it was the boldness that brings freedom. In this case, it was Jael picking up that hammer and that tent peg and going through with what she'd started planning to do. When we're bold in Christ. We're bold in our faith. We're bold in Him because of what He does, because of His Spirit, because of His cross. We're bold in Him. I'm not bold in me. I might think I'm really great. I might think I'm really funny. I'm not really funny at all. But it's certainly true that faithlessness brings ruin and boldness brings freedom. Just another example of how men are quite boastful. So yesterday I was at a conference with Rural Ministries near Derby, and there were 8 of us sitting around the table, men and women, and it got close to the end, and a guy on the table had to leave early. And I knew his name. That was about it, really. That was about all I knew of him, except that I knew he was obviously involved in some kind of evangelistic project where he was. And when he got up, the first thing I noticed was his chair was empty. But then the second thing was that, just as I noticed that, was that his hand came in from the side, passed me a business card and said, "Keep in touch." And I'm wondering what to do with that, because I don't know anything about him. I don't know why he wants me to particularly keep in touch with him. I mean, sure, let's all be friendly, that's great. You know, that's fine, no problem with that. But was he saying, "Keep in touch because I think you should come and join my ministry at some point"? And I want to say to you guys, I have no intention of doing that. I'm here, I love being here, and I'm here to serve here. So I don't really understand what he thought he was doing. But it's the kind of thing men do. Here, have my business card and keep in touch because, you know, you might need me. You know, I could make use of you. I've never known a woman do that. But that's the kind of boastful thing that men do. Here's my great ministry, keep in touch. He wasn't like that particularly, but, you know, it was that. It's just something that men do. And it's just rubbish. You know? I haven't yet decided whether I'm going to send him an email or not. But if I do, it will say something like, "Thank you for leaving me your business card. What was it you wanted me to keep in touch about?" Because I don't know. Here's the second thing about redressing the balance. Men need to respect the voice of women. In and through the cross, God gives His Spirit. We believe that. Peter stands up, Acts chapter 2, on Pentecost day and says, "Look, this is the Spirit being poured out. This is a fulfillment of the prophet Joel, who said, in the last days, God will pour out His Spirit on His people. Your sons and your daughters will prophesy." Sorry, who's going to prophesy? Sons and daughters. Oh, right, okay. So it's not just the sons then. No, it's not. It's the sons and daughters. Okay, great. 1 Corinthians 11, a controversial passage. Leaving the issue of head coverings to one side, the interesting thing there is that Paul makes the assumption that women are and should both pray and prophesy in church gatherings. His problem is not with the fact that they do. The issue that he raises is about the way about how they go about doing that. So the voice of women needs to be heard because God has given that. There are 5 women in the Old Testament named as prophetesses. In the New Testament, it's Philip's daughters in Acts 21:9 are described as having the gift of prophecy, as being able to prophesy. There are others, men, who are specifically named. One in particular is Agabus. And he crops up a couple of times in Acts. He plays a part in the story of Acts. But this is almost like a throwaway comment by Luke, that Philip has these daughters. I can't remember if it's 3 or 4 daughters that he's got, but they have the gift of prophecy. Why does God give them that? Because He expects them to use it. And when God speaks, we need to listen. So it's really important that we respect and hear the voice of women. Again, just to give you an example from yesterday, sitting around that table, 8 of us there. 4 guys. 4 women. We were looking at Acts chapter 10. That story about that vision that Peter has with the sheep that's let down from heaven with all the animals in it and God saying to Peter, get up, kill and eat. It's that story anyway we were looking at. And it was really interesting watching the way in which the discussion took place around that table. Because one man seemed to think that it was his job to lead a Bible study on that passage. He didn't say, I'm going to lead the Bible study on that passage. But when somebody started talking, he asked a question as if he was leading a Bible study. And when she gave him the answer he wanted, he said, yes, that's correct. You know, as if she needed to be told or that this was the correct thing. And it was a minor point. It wasn't actually the issues that we were asked to discuss. But he felt he had to do that. And then as that discussion went on, again, the other guy, the one that gave me the business card, he was talking, and he was talking directly to these women. He didn't look at me. He didn't look at the other guy or guys. He talked to the women as if they needed to know this because the rest of us already knew it. I thought, what is going on? We're sitting around this table as equals. None of us has been appointed a leader here. We're here each to give our reflections on that passage and to learn from one another's response. That's what I mean about respecting the voice of women. I'm going to stop there for today. Let's pray.